I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. A senior Trump administration official said Thursday that Ukraine was given a fair warning by the White House before U.S. President Donald Trump this week ordered a pause on American military assistance and intelligence sharing with Kyiv. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
A Trump envoy says Ukraine has itself to blame for a pause on American military aid and intelligence sharing.
They brought it on themselves.
Keith Kellogg, the president's special envoy to Ukraine and Russia, tells the Council on Foreign Relations Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky was told last week's Oval Office talks would focus on signing a rare earth minerals deal with the U.S.
The best way I can describe it is sort of like hitting a mule with a 2x4 across the nose. You got their attention.
Zelensky says he's still willing to sign the minerals deal. Kellogg says he cannot guarantee weapons will again flow to Ukraine, even if that happens. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Top U.S. and British defense officials met Thursday to work on how to best quickly bring an end to the fighting between Russia and Ukraine. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more from the Pentagon.
British Defense Secretary John Healey.
He challenged us to step up on Ukraine, on defense spending, on European security. And I say to you that we have, we are, and we will further.
On potential peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, Healey said Britain believes Kyiv is ready to make the most of a, quote, unique opportunity. But as for whether the U.S. has seen enough to resume intelligence sharing with Ukraine, the U.S. Defense Secretary said that's up to President Trump. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
This is VOA News. The Palestinian militant group Hamas on Thursday brushed off President Trump's latest threat and reiterated that it will only free the remaining Israeli hostages in exchange for a lasting ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman has more from Jerusalem.
The Trump administration is talking to Hamas. White House officials acknowledge that an envoy recently met a Hamas delegation in the Qatari capital of Doha. There are no reports of any breakthroughs during this meeting in ongoing ceasefire efforts between Israel and Hamas. Nonetheless, this marks the first time a U.S. administration has publicly acknowledged meeting with the militant group. Both the U.S. and Israel consider Hamas to be a terrorist organization. This meeting comes at a sensitive time when ceasefire efforts are at a standstill. The first phase of the ceasefire ended, and since then, the sides have been unable to find a way forward. President Trump is taking a tough public line. He met with a group of recently released Israeli hostages at the White House, and afterwards he said he was issuing his last warning to Hamas to release all remaining hostages in Hamas captivity. The militant group responded with its own tough statement. It says no more hostage releases unless it is part of a lasting ceasefire agreement. So for the time being, we are seeing very tough public posturing by the various sides. At the same time, we now know of an ongoing dialogue between the U.S. and Hamas that could open the door to some backroom negotiations.
AP correspondent Joe Fetterman. The Trump administration suffered a legal blow on Thursday after a second judge ruled to block its sweeping spending freeze on programs that don't align with the U.S. president's agenda. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin reports.
U.S. District Judge John McConnell said the Trump administration had, quote, put itself above Congress. His ruling builds on an earlier temporary order he issued in January, blocking the freeze. The funding freeze was initially announced in a since-rescinded memo from the White House Budget Office. It directed federal agencies to temporarily pause spending on grants until the administration could determine that the funding complied with Trump's executive orders. That includes orders ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and pausing spending on projects that combat climate change. The Trump administration is expected to appeal the decision, though they have tried to do so before and were denied.
Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan files a case against the paramilitary RSF at the International Court of Justice.
All the weapons, it comes from United Arab Emirates. They are the one who sponsor those militia. If they are not supplying the weapon, this war wouldn't be like it's done for 1 month.
South Sudan's SPLMAIO condemns what it calls the arbitrary detention of its members. Activists call for measurable action towards gender equality as the world marks International Women's Day tomorrow, Saturday. Guinea's military junta says 2025 will be the year of elections, but some ask, is the country ready?
As we speak, we don't have the electoral list. We don't have the electoral commission to manage the process. We don't have the constitution either.
And the U.S. and Britain talk war in Ukraine and European defense, and a summit of European Union leaders vows to increase investments in defense. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Sudanese political leader says the country's military-led government has every right to sue the United Arab Emirates for supplying weapons to the paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF. Hussein Shingraya, the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan, says the war would have ended long ago without that support. The International Court of Justice announced on Thursday that Sudan filed a case accusing the UAE of violating the Genocide Convention by arming and funding the rebel RSF. The Associated Press reports that UAE has described the case as nothing more than a cynical publicity stunt. Hussein Shiringrai tells me that the evidence has shown that the UAE has been supplying weapons to the RSF.
Sudan is suing the United Arab Emirates because it is the major supply of the all the weapons that it comes from United Arab Emirates. They are the one who sponsor those militia. If they are not supplying the weapon, this war wouldn't be like it's done for 1 month. They try through the all Arab countries to stop that, but they never listen and they never, you know, stop anything. For 2 years, they do support the weapons for the militia, and it's still continuing that.
The United Arab Emirates is saying that Sudan is suing because it is trying to hide its own involvement and atrocities that it is committing in the war.
You know, they can say whatever they want to say, but everybody knows that. Every Sudanese, they know that, you know, it's all weapons that comes from United Arab Emirates. And they found, you know, in the weapon itself, it's written that it's been those made for United Arab Emirates. And the boxes and every weapon that is being used, comes from United Arab Emirates direct. And also they found, you know, some identification, you know, for people that's from United Arab Emirates. They were there, and some of them has been catch during this war. And I think the government of Sudan, they have all the evidence that United Arab Emirates is involved in that. And everybody knows because they are the major people that benefit, you know, from the relationship with the militia because they're supplying them with the gold.
I'm thinking, okay, what is wrong with the RSF getting weapons from anywhere, let alone UAE? Because the RSF, they are fighting a war. So what's wrong with them getting weapons from anywhere they want to get the weapons?
It's not just getting weapons. If you look at the weapons during this war for 2 years, that's become billions of dollars. No militia in the world that can afford to have enough money for that. But because it's being supplied by the United Arab Emirates, because they have an interest in Sudan, which is they're looking for to have the gold and even have the ports from Port Sudan, and they have the land for agriculture.
How do we know the UAE is giving weapons to the RSF because it's looking for gold? Do we have evidence for that?
Yes, we do have. If you look at the United Arab Emirates, you will see that is the major gold market, and they don't have even one mine in their land from where they get that gold.
Hussein Shingraya is the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan. He was speaking with us from the U.S. state of Maryland. A Guinean political leader says the country is ready to have elections to end military rule, but only if the conditions are ripe. This after the country's Prime Minister Baoure announced this week that 2025 will be the year of elections, including for president. He did not say whether military leader General Mamadi Doumbouya is going to run for president or not. Fayyami Limuno is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party. He says Guinea does not have a constitution, electoral list, or even an electoral commission to manage any election. Yet he tells me that supporters of General Doumbouya have already been campaigning around the country.
We are listening to the speeches that the junta, the government, the prime minister are giving. But we are still hoping that what they're saying is going to be the case. Because talking about elections, talking about referendum, is not the first time we're talking about it. Remember, at the end of 2023, the referendum was announced for 2024. It didn't happen. We don't even have a project of the Constitution yet. We just have the first draft of the Constitution. So if they come to tell us that 2025 is going to be the year of elections, we are in March 2025. As we speak, we don't have the electoral list. We don't have the electoral commission to manage the process. We don't have the constitution either. Elections, we are praying for it. But for now, there is nothing in place to help us support the idea that 2025 is going to be the year of elections.
Assuming that everything is correct, that 2025 is the year of the election, would the opposition be ready for such election?
Listen, we need elections to end this transitional period. We need elections. But from what we know in Africa, everywhere we went through the nightmare, let's say civil war, in many countries in Africa, the origin of everything is bad elections. We need to learn from our mistakes. What is happening on our watch here in Conakry, in Guinea, it is difficult to say what is going to be the outcome. I am very concerned about the future of this country.
The military leader himself, Doumbouya, has he said that he is going to run or not?
Doumbouya has not said yet that he's going to run, but if you listen to the spokesperson of the presidential palace, if you listen to the spokesperson of the government, if you listen to the prime minister, you listen to the government, to the whole public administration, they have a candidate. And that candidate's name is Doumbouya. They are doing the campaign without any constitution, without anybody saying he is a candidate, but they are already in campaign. They're going throughout the country spending public money.
Fayyami Limuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. South Sudan's main opposition group says its members are in a state of panic as government security operatives intensify a crackdown, arresting senior officials and forcing others into hiding. The office of First Vice President Riek Machar has confirmed that the National Minister of Peace Building, Stephen Parkour, was arrested on Thursday along with his bodyguards and his secretary in his office. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
Ok Both Baluang is the acting press secretary in the office of First Vice President Riek Machar, who heads the SPLM-IO opposition group.
The National Security decided to arrest the Minister of Peace Building and the Secretary General of the NTC, Honorable Stephen Parkul, from his office. He was arrested along with his private secretary, Julius Lack, plus two of his bodyguards.
Minister Parkwal is the third senior SPLM AIO official to be detained. This week, government forces have detained the SPLM AIO military commander, Gabriel Duop Lam, and the National Minister of Petroleum, Port Kang Chol, who were arrested in Juba. Pal Mai Deng, the spokesperson of the SPLM-IO, condemned the arrests.
What has happened is not only the violations of the Right Lives Agreement on the resolutions of conflict in South Sudan, it's also a violation of South Sudan Constitution, because what we have in the Constitution is that once you're going to be arrested, you must be notified of the reasons of your arrest. You have to be given an arrest warrant. And even after your arrest, you have to appear before the court of law within 48 hours. This hasn't been done. We're asking SPLMIG to release these senior officials as soon as possible.
At a news conference on Wednesday, Information Minister and Government Spokesperson Michael Makuei-Lueth confirmed the arrest but did not say what was behind them or whether the detainees would face trial. Mai says the opposition members are being targeted in Juba and other states. He warned that the continued arbitrary arrest and intimidation of SPLM-AIO leaders endanger the peace agreement. Tensions between the ruling SPLM, led by President Salva Kiir, and the SPLM-IO, led by First Vice President Riek Machar, have stalled the implementation of the 2018 revitalized peace agreement. Each side has accused the other of violating the deal. The latest arrests follow a deadly clash on Monday in Nasir County between the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the White Army Militia, which reportedly resulted in multiple casualties. The government has accused SPLM-AIO leaders of collaborating with the militia, a charge the opposition denies. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Juba.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, March 7th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. As the global community commemorates International Women's Day, March 8, activists are calling on individuals, organizations, and governments to take measurable action toward gender equality and women's empowerment in Africa. Our reporter in Abuja, Nigeria, has more.
International Women's Day serves as a reminder of the ongoing challenges women face in their daily lives despite playing vital roles in society. Across Africa, women face an array of barriers to achieving their full potential, from restrictive cultural practices to discriminatory laws and highly segmented labor markets. Vivian Ovie-Whiskey is a legal practitioner and an advocate for human and women rights. She told VOA that to narrow gender gaps in Africa, laws that promote equal pay, land rights, and maternity protection must be implemented without compromise.
We must take a multifaceted approach that addresses the systemic inequalities at every level. First, let us start by strengthening legal protections and accountability. Gender-based violence, discriminatory laws, and cultural practices that oppress women must be totally abolished. This requires robust legal frameworks, strict enforcement, and accessible justice mechanisms for women and girls.
Adora Sydney Jack, the executive director of Gender Strategy Advancement International, says that equal access to quality education can play a pivotal role in countries in Africa.
Education for me is a pathway towards women's employment, towards women's mainstreaming, towards bridging the gender gap, towards empowerment, improved health. It brings tangible benefits for the women and the girls, and including the citizens as well.
Speaking on this year's Women's Day theme, which is Accelerate Action, Sydney Jack notes that significant barriers to gender equality remain in Africa, but that with right strategies, positive progress can be made for women everywhere.
For women in Africa, there is an urgent need indeed to accelerate this action in strategies that will mitigate. For me as a woman, as an African woman, I'm looking forward to strategies that will mitigate the lack of agency for women's voices in politics and the need to tackle the exclusion of women in policy making.
Meanwhile, the International Labour Organization, or ILO, says it will mark this year's International Women's Day by celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and its platform for action, with a special event reflecting on the three decades of progress in the world of work. The Assistant Director General for Governance, Rights and Dialogue at the ILO, Emanuela Tommy, is happy with the progress women have made over the past 30 years.
Globally, there are more women in the workforce than ever before. There are more women-owned businesses and women at the head of enterprises, more women in managerial positions, stronger legal protections against discrimination, including in respect of violence and harassment, stronger care policies supporting working women and families, stronger representation of women in trade unions, as well as in employers and business membership organizations.
Tommy, however, says that the pace of progress had been too modest and that it will take nearly two centuries to achieve equal employment rate between women and men. This is VOA News in Abuja, Nigeria.
Africa's top public health agency says that Uganda's Ebola case low increases to 14 in the last week, with a new cluster emerging from a 14-year-old child who recently died of the infectious diseases, the Associated Press reports. Three of five new cases have been confirmed as Ebola, with two cited as probably Ebola, according to Dr. Ngashi Ngongo of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Africa CDC reported that there was no epidemiological link between the new cluster and another one, accounting for nine previous Ebola cases, including the first victim of the outbreak. Ebola is now spreading in five of Uganda's 146 districts. European Union leaders vowed to ramp up funding for Ukraine and their own defense at a summit in Brussels on Thursday as they take steps to rearm in ways they haven't since the end of the Cold War. From Paris, Lisa Bryan has more on the summit, which was attended by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
This was the first summit for all 27 EU members since last week's confrontational White House meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and after Washington's decision to suspend aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine.
Europe faces a clear and present danger, and therefore Europe has to be able to protect itself, to defend itself, as we have to put Ukraine in a position to protect itself and to push for a lasting and just peace.
That's the message from European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen about her $865 billion Rearm Europe plan. It aims to drastically boost Europe's defense arsenal against what many here see as a growing Russian threat and possibly the U.S.'s disengagement from the region. She spoke alongside Zelensky, who was invited for part of the summit.
We are very thankful that we are not alone, and these are not just words, we feel it.
J'ai décidé d'ouvrir le débat stratégique.
Beyond boosting Europe's conventional arsenal, French President Emmanuel Macron has floated extending his country's nuclear arsenal to other European allies, which he also explained to French voters back home. In a televised address to the nation Wednesday, he called Russia a threat to Europe for years to come, remarks denounced by Moscow. In Brussels, many EU leaders echoed the urgency of rearming, like Latvian Prime Minister Evika Salina, whose own country borders Russia and has already sharply boosted its defense spending.
We see a good proposals for von der Leyen, but we see it's just one step. We need more steps going forward, and we see really it's a good opportunity for Ukraine to get peace, but through strength.
The EU sees a strong peace deal for Kyiv as serving its own interests as well, to ensure Europe doesn't go beyond Ukraine to attack its own member states. But some European leaders have misgivings, including Hungary's Viktor Orban, who has friendly relations with Moscow. Just as important as pouring more money into defense, analysts say, is investing strategically and pooling resources. Here's Ian Lesser, Brussels Bureau Office head for the German Marshall Fund of the United States.
The resources that would be needed to rebuild Europe's defense industrial capacity, or to build what is in essence a European army, even within NATO, but for Europe to pay much more and do much more, is going to require some kind of collective action and collective finance, probably.
A key question moving forward, analysts say, is to what extent Europe will be procuring equipment from the United States, as it has in the past, one key way to potentially keep close ties, or investing in its own industrial capacity. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with cricket as South Africa under 19 women are through to the Super 6 stage of the ICC under 19 Women's T20 World Cup following their resounding victory against Nigeria under 19 women in their final group stage encounter. The match was reduced to 8 overs per side after rain interrupted play. South Africa delivered a composed performance, scoring 49 runs in their allotted overs. The junior Proteas restricted the Euro Greens of Nigeria to 24-8, claiming a comfortable 41-run victory to remain unbeaten and secure the top spot in Group C. Despite their loss against South Africa, Nigeria finished second in Group C and also stamped their ticket into the next round, where they will face England on Saturday in the first Super Six clash before meeting Ireland next Wednesday. And onto athletics, where Ethiopia's Wokenish Edessa returns to the Osaka Women's Marathon as a course record holder, aiming to retain her title at the World Athletics Platinum Level Road Race on Sunday. Edessa took more than 2 minutes off the course record last year, matching her personal best of 2 hours, 18 minutes, 51 seconds, set in Berlin in 2022. She won by 8 seconds from Japan's Hanami Maeda, who clocked an Asian record of 2 hours, 18 minutes, 59 seconds. This time, Edessa's competition includes Japan's Mizuki Matsuda and Natsumi Matsushita. Edessa won 2 of the 3 marathons she contested in 2024. In football news, Morocco aims to complete construction of a 115,000-seater stadium in Benslimane near Casablanca by 2027, 3 years before the World Cup. It is co-hosting with Spain and Portugal. Morocco's Minister Delegate for Budget, Fawzi Lagjoa, said the stadium, one of the largest in the world, will cost up to $500 million to build. The stadium is competing to host the opening and final round of the World Cup alongside the Santiago Bernabeu in Madrid and the Camp Nou in Barcelona, according to a FIFA report. And now to tennis, where Kenya won 3 gold at the International Tennis Federation, ITF, Confederation of African Tennis, Eastern African Junior Team Championships 2025 that concluded on Thursday at the Nairobi Club. Thursday's performance follows Kenya's first week success, where the host nation claimed 5 individual titles. Meanwhile, ITF Development Officer for East and Central Africa, Ntuwale Thierry, announced that Kenya will host the Under-14 Africa Junior Championships at the end of February. And finally, 44 rally drivers have confirmed their participation in this weekend's Federation of Motorsport Clubs in Uganda NRC calendar opener, popularly known as the Mambara Rally. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, March 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botta in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.